Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody. This is Sara Gone Rogue, and it is Sara Gone herself who has ceased being rogue for the next hour and welcomes you to all that is new and annoying and fascinating about politics generally in South Africa. I just thought I would make one comment about starvation, and that is that starving children have very skinny arms, very skinny limbs, very sort of bloated heads, but they also have very bloated stomachs and tend to take on an almost their hair takes on an orange tinge. I can't go into the medical details of it, but that is what starving children look like. For what it is worth. Well, we will be looking at with our guest this morning, Marius Ruit, who is something of an expert on electoral systems and the whole issue of changing our electoral system. It's an incredibly complex subject, even though instinctively it should be perhaps logical, but hopefully he will help to unpack what the problems are and what we need to look at, if not specifically, then generally about a new system. Last week, we managed to finally have the National Assembly pass the Appropriation Bill, which is that part of the budget process that allocates funds to government departments and entities. And it is really the last major component that has to be adopted for the budget as a whole to be passed. And if you think about the fact that this whole process started in February and the DA went head-to-head with the ANC for the manner in which and the content of the proposed budget and the manner in which it had been dealt, the ANC had dealt with its coalition partners on it. Essentially, what the Democratic Alliance did was leverage its votes and extracted two major concessions from the ANC as a result. The first, and it's starting to feel like ancient history, is to reverse the tax increase, which would have raised VAT from 14% to 16% over 2 years. That's a 2 percentage point increase. That would have affected everyone negatively, and politically it strikes me as a very questionable thing to have done. The second extraction, the second concession it got, was the actual firing of the ANC Minister of Higher Education and Training, one Nobuhle Mqabane, for having misled Parliament about how ANC cadres were deployed as chairpersons of sectoral education and training authorities. Now, she stuck to her guns until obviously they had decided that she was just way too much liability for the ANC in the GNU. Misleading Parliament is the ultimate crime, if I can put it that way, and the whole sector education and training, the CETA environment has been under scrutiny for some years for being an environment in which corruption, mismanagement, poor allocation of resources, tenderpreneurship, etc., have been rife to the detriment of South Africans who need education, and particularly who need training in skills that can help to create a work stream and a career for a person. The consequences essentially are that it's probably likely, although one can probably debate this, that the GNU will survive another year, that the GA will have to be tough and negotiate hard. It cannot rely on the ANC to follow its agreements with the DA, and that Cyril Ramaphosa's position is seen possibly as weak for having triggered an ANC back down, and the DA is therefore seen by the ANC, who are opposed to them as unreliable and that Cyril is not controlling it properly. So that's what the budget and the consequence of it foretells for the future.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'm going to talk about a development that arose yesterday, and that was the decision to step down as spokesperson on international relations for the Democratic Alliance, and that is the decision taken by Emma Louise Powell. Now, we know that she went on a fact-finding mission to Washington earlier this year to see what, with a couple of colleagues, to see what South Africa needed to do to repair a poor relationship with the United States. And it wasn't the DA's relationship with the United States, it was the ANC government's non-existent relationship with the United States. And the details of that everyone will be familiar with. But she says, over the past 2.5 years, she has traveled the world on behalf of her party, first as shadow minister and later as national spokesperson, speaking out against some of the most repressive and brutal regimes in the world. She goes on to say that, and this is interesting, and we'll unpack it a little bit later, many of these regimes are more closely enmeshed with government leaders, and the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, DIRCO, than the public realizes. In defending South Africa's constitutional values on the international stage, she's been threatened, intimidated, harassed, and illegally surveilled. In fact, the DA is seeking a PIA application to force the security agencies to release a report that allegedly was seen by the Sowetan, accusing her essentially of undermining South Africa's interests in her dealings with the United States. I would not hesitate to suggest that the only entity that is undermining South Africa's interests or giving South Africa a bad name is the very ANC that she and her colleagues are trying to moderate their views in order to improve relationships. She says she did accept the risks as unavoidable. It was a cost that came with standing up to and exposing DIRCO and the ANC's relationships with authoritarian regimes. And essentially, it's clear that standing up to bullies and the pressures that come with public life have taken their toll. And in an environment that rewards expediency, truly in principled leadership is rare and often costly. She's grateful to her colleagues, and she will remain an MP on behalf of the DA in Parliament. Now, there has been criticism of her decision. She hasn't been able to withstand the pressure. Some have accused her of painting South Africa in a bad light, etc. But I have to express sympathy. It must be a nightmare dealing with DIRCO, which is avowedly, as far as the ANC is concerned, in the domain of the ANC and the ANC only. And when she talks about relationships with authoritarian regimes, perhaps another event that's happening currently or has just happened that will point to the sort of regimes that the ANC is supportive of was the Southern African Liberation Movement Summit of 2025. Now, it's not just the former liberation parties or the covenant liberation parties who were intended. It was the Communist Party of China. Now, the Communist Party of China is long since 1949, ceased to be a liberation movement. The Polisario Front from what they call the Sahari Republic, which is really disputed territory with Morocco, which is now, that dispute has now arisen because MK has shown support for Morocco. So, you know, such are the changes in the zeitgeist. Fatah, the FLN of Algeria, which ran probably one of the 20th century's most violent civil wars in the world, and it did evict France as the colonial power in Algeria, but the cost was huge. And the FLN is Hamas's go-to organization for how it sees its way to tackle the existence of Israel. United Russia, now this is astonishing. It is Vladimir Putin's party. Unless they're trying to hark back to the 1917 revolution, all it is welcoming those autocracies who's long past any liberation of anything and continue to run their countries as political parties, as autocracies, as in the worst possible way possible. The Sandinistas of Nicaragua are there, and this, I have to say, I find quite funny, is that the PAC of Azania. Now, the PAC, which is an ideologically different liberation movement to that of the ANC, has always pretty much only achieved one, at the best, two members of parliament. It has not transformed in a way that can make it a political force in the South African landscape. Over 30 years after democratic government became a reality in South Africa. And the ANC has had the cringeworthy reference to Azania, and I'm sure that the PAC asked it to, because the PAC believes that Azania is what is the should be the real name of South Africa. That is a debate for another time, and it is, as much of these things are, a distorted, phony debate, but be it as it may. That gives you some idea of the sort of states that Emma Powell had to deal with, and got an insight into the machinations of ANC relationships with countries who will tolerate, if not encourage, malfeasance and worse. It also goes to explaining why America is a problem for the ANC, because it will not, whatever the rights or wrongs of American society may be, an American government, it is the world's largest democracy, and it is the world's largest market, and we are going to pay seriously for that enormous misjudgment.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
A very challenging topic, believe it or not, one that one thinks should be completely intuitive, but is not, and that is, what sort of electoral system should South Africa have? Now, I have in the studio my colleague Marius Root, who has becoming something of an expert on it and has written an extraordinarily detailed paper on our current electoral system, its problems, the range of options, and perhaps some recommendations on what we should be looking at. I've put down the challenge to you, Marius, to pack everything that I'm going to lead you in 20 minutes. Welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Nice to be here.
Marius, we have an electoral system. It's briefly, how would you describe it, and what is its shortcomings?
So the electoral system we use in South Africa to elect parliament and our provincial legislatures is, political scientists call it the party list proportional system. That's because it uses proportional representation. So it's the proportion of the votes the party gets is very closely linked to the proportion of seats it gets in parliament. And it's called the party list system because people don't actually vote for a person. They just vote for a party. And then the party provides a list of candidates of who will go to parliament. So a party will generally give however many people, say 100 candidates to the IEC, And if they get, 5% of the vote, then that equates to 20 MPs, because we have 400 MPs. So 5% of 400 is 20, whatever the case is. So then the first 20 people on that list will then go to Parliament. Mm. So the problem with that, though, is that voters have very little control over who represents them. It's basically parties have, they can decide who represents people in Parliament. So often, you might vote for a party and you'll like what it stands for, but there might be one or two people that who are quite high up on the list that you're not really a fan of, but there's no way of really controlling that. If you want to vote for that party, then if those people are high up on the list, then they're going to get in. But one of the things that is one of the strengths of the system is the proportional representation aspect of it. We've seen in other countries which use what's called the Westminster system, the first-past-the-post system in the UK. Often the proportion of the vote will be quite out of sync with the number of seats they win. That's because each seat comes from a geographical constituency. So we saw that in the UK last year, where the Labour Party won, I think, actually just under a third of the vote. They got nearly 60% of the seats in Westminster. Incredible. Same thing happened here in South Africa in 1948, when the National Party won. They just missed out on a majority in that election. But Jan Smuts's United Party had got almost 50% of the vote. Because of the electoral system worked, the National Party managed to get into power. And obviously that was a big moment for South Africa. And, I think a lot of people would agree that it was not a great moment for South Africa.
Well, it raises the most awful counterfactuals of what would have happened if the system had been different.
Exactly. Or if Jan Smuts had Jan Smuts, by our standards, he'd probably be pretty racist, but I think he was a bit less racist than the Nats at the time, and he knew that you can really treat people who weren't white the way that people were being treated in those days. But yeah, so the electoral system we have been using, we decided to use it in 1994 because of this proportional representation aspect, and it helps to get minorities into the system, whether that's racial or ethnic or religious minorities or people who, ideological minorities, people who got some funny ideas about things. So that's why in 1994 we decided to use that system. Mm. And it was always going to be just kind of a stopgap system. There was always by the late 90s or early 2000s, we'd look to use a different electoral system. The only requirement is that the system results, I don't know the exact wording, but something like results in general proportional representation or broadly in proportional representation, something like that. But that is the only requirement in the constitution for our electoral system. So we have to have some form of proportional representation. So what we've proposed is to have what's called a mixed member system. So that's where some of your MPs will be elected from a geographical constituency, and then you'll have a parallel list to ensure that there's proportionality. That's actually the system we use at municipal level in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Joburg, you'll get two votes. You'll get one for your candidate, for your area, for wherever you live, whatever part of Joburg or Ekurhuleni, whatever the case is, that person will represent your area. Let's call it a suburb, even though it's generally a bit bigger than a suburb. Then you get another vote to vote for a political party to ensure proportionality. So that's the system we've proposed, where you get, say, around about half of MPs, maybe a bit more, could be elected from geographical constituencies, and then another number, just depending on we decide on, would then be elected from party list to ensure that there's proportionality. Mm-hmm. So the strengths in that system is that there'll be links, will be strengthened between communities and between representatives. At the moment, nobody, even people who follow politics closely, because in theory, MPs are assigned to areas to represent them. But that's just, it's really theoretical. Mm-hmm. Nobody really takes that seriously. But if MPs are elected from actual areas, that will strengthen the link between representatives and voters. And I think that could change a whole bunch of incentives. Political parties would have to put up high-caliber candidates, I think, to ensure that they win areas and so on. People, I think, issues that aren't really heard about now could be brought to the fore. One thing I've said before, and we've heard about Day Zero in Cape Town and water issues in Johannesburg and so on. There are areas in South Africa that have had day zero for 10 years, but nobody cares about it because it's in some small town in Northwest or Limpopo, whatever the case is. But if they had an MP who was representing them and there was pressure from the community for these things to be resolved, imagine an MP for whatever it is, say Tuyandu in Limpopo, and he stands up every time he's in Parliament and says, "Mr. President, my constituents haven't had water for 5 years. What is going to happen?" And then he's always on TV and he's in social media, whatever the case is. Or another example I like to talk about is the one of Colin Skorza, the man who was beaten to death by the army in, during COVID for having a beer in his yard. He wasn't even breaking COVID rules. And nobody's even been brought to justice for that. But imagine the MP for Alexandra. If you could say every time he would get up in Parliament, say, "Mr. President, what is happening about... is anybody being brought to justice for the death of Colin Skorza?" I think that would change incentives. It could change how South African politics works. And one thing that's also an issue in South Africa is the decline in the proportion of people who vote in our elections. So in the last election in South Africa, out of all registered voters, about 60% of people turned up in last year's election, which isn't a bad number. But if you look at eligible voters, that includes all South Africans over the age of 18, but not everybody goes to register to vote. If you look at that number, then fewer than 50% of South Africans voted in last year's election. If you look at the 2021 local government election, only about 30% of eligible voters turned out. So that's actually quite a problem. And I think in the long run, it could actually pose an existential threat to South African democracy. So this is one way of getting people more engaged. Obviously, this isn't a silver bullet. It's going to be up to political parties and to voters. But I think we have to think of ways to get people to be more interested in politics and be to get more involved. And we think this is one way of doing it. And the Electoral Reform Consultation Panel, which was put together by the government, they are presenting their findings at the end of August. And as I understand it, they have been considering three proposals to keep the electoral system as it is now, which is quite... I don't think that's a good idea. Then the proposal that we've given out, where you have a number of MPs elected from single member constituencies, parallel top up list, and another proposal to have multi member constituencies. So each constituency would have more than one MP, and then you'd still have your parallel top up list. But that also brings on in a lot of its own problems. It's actually just replicates the problems that we currently have. It'll be hard for individuals to stand on equal footing with political parties and so on. And yeah, so there's, I think this is probably the last real opportunity for electoral reform we're going to have for another 20 or 30 years, because we've seen in South Africa, this is the first time we're going to have a real opportunity for electoral reform. But if we miss it, it could be another 30 years before we do have another chance to do it.
I mean, just sort of to talk broadly about the idea of voting, one of the things I've promoted often on this program is the absolute necessity of exercising that right to vote. The cliche has often been, well, you know, my vote doesn't count, or I'm disillusioned with, and one can understand the disillusion because the system does favor party sort of. The parties giving fillip to people who have no accountability to people. So the party is the only entity they have any link to, and this has resulted in all sorts of allegations of corruption and mismanagement, etc. So we don't need to go into that. But there are two. What I keep trying to impress upon people is that that one vote replicated not very many times can make the difference, and perhaps the best example is that of the Umgeni municipality. Now, we are dealing with municipal elections, not national or provincial, but there you've got a situation where getting elderly voters from nearby retirement homes to the voting station to vote, actually encouraging them and helping them just to get there. I think that caused the DA to win Umgeni by something like 19 or 20 votes. It was literally, you know, you could gather those number of people in the restaurant downstairs, and that swung it. On so little, so much was determined and so much changed. Can I presume the thinking behind the recommendation of the combination of proportional and constituency is that if one encourage one further encouragement for that moment of absolute equality across the country is that if you have someone who is actually depends on their position on satisfying the voters, you can really encourage that that move away from that. Well, I'm only one vote. I don't count.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's exactly it. It'll get people be encouraged to vote, and that'll just, as I say, it'll change all kinds of incentives. But also, like I said, this isn't a silver bullet. There's people in South Africa who will vote ANC till the day they die. They'll vote DA till the day that they die. And this isn't just in South Africa. I mean, this is abroad as well. You'll get people whose grandparents voted Labour Party, so that's why they vote Labour Party. In the US as well, somebody who votes Republican wouldn't even dare think of voting Democrat and other way around and so on. But this does change incentives, and voting patterns in South Africa are changing. People like to say that nothing's changed since 1994 and so on, but that's definitely not true. People do change the way they vote, and we've seen even in Johannesburg. I mean, if you look at the 2011 election, ANC got, I think, nearly 70% of the votes in the municipal election. In the 2021 local government election, even if you put the ANC and EFF together, they didn't even get 50%.
Mm.
So those votes are going somewhere. Some of them are going to the DA, some of them are going to the IFP, some are going to the PA, whatever. So people, voting patterns are changing, but I think this will encourage people to vote. But I think that's a very important point to make on how important a single vote is. Obviously, one vote very rarely swings an election. But one vote times 20 or times 30 or times 100, as you point out in Umgeni, I think you're right. I don't know the exact number was, but it was a handful of people. If those people hadn't voted for the DA or voted for somebody else, the DA wouldn't have got a majority in Umgeni, and they would have to have gone into a coalition. But same thing happened in Germany. So Germany's got what's called an electoral threshold. To get into the Bundestag there, you have to get at least 5% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an election in one of the German states. I can't remember which one. And there's a party called the Free Democratic Party. If they'd got 80 fewer votes out of something like, I don't know what it was, a couple of million cast, I think it was only 80. They got 80 fewer votes, they wouldn't have got the 5%, they wouldn't have crossed the 5% threshold to get into the Bundestag. So those 80 votes made a big difference. Then that's, you know, changed the composition of the, or was it one, the Bundestag was a state election, but whatever, I think it's called Bundesrats there, whatever the case is. But they would have changed the composition, would have changed people's careers, would have changed the composition of the state parliament and so on. So people's, you can't emphasize enough how important somebody's vote is. And
right.
I mean, it is a cliche, but people have died for our right to vote.
One thing I've become aware of, and we'll go back to just looking generally at the proposals for electoral reform, is that the height of the ANC's success, which you referred to, occurred in a period when the ANC was really delivering in every respect: housing, electricity, water, education, etc. And it's tracked as it should, as it's delivered less, or benefits have fallen away because of maladministration, poor performance, corruption, etc. The number of people who vote, who've exercised the vote, who have the right to exercise the vote, has dropped dramatically, as you've alluded to. But also there's a level I'm sensing, particularly with either lifelong ANC voters of a certain age, shall we say, or young people who are perhaps a generation removed from having lived under apartheid. There's a level of anger that suggests that the situation is both exciting and febrile at the moment, and that things could look very different. Would that have any impact on the likelihood of there actually being a change in our electoral system in the next few years? Or do you think it's something that a party like the ANC will kick it into touch because it's the system it's relied on?
I think there would have maybe been a chance of the ANC kicking into touch a couple of years ago, but I think things have changed a lot now with the ANC being under 40% or 40% of the vote. So obviously can't have things all its own way, even though it still acts like it's a 70% party, it's a 40% party. So I think the chances of electoral reform are much better than they've been for some time, I think. And I think there is, people do want a change, I think. The Institute of Race Relations actually also did some polling earlier this year. I can't remember the exact numbers, but something like 70% of people want to be able to directly elect their member of parliament.
Mm.
So people really want to be able to have a say in who represents them in parliament. And I think it'll be difficult for the ANC to push against this change. That all said, this system also benefits all our parties, really, because it's gives power to the party bosses. So whether it's the DA, the EFF, or the ACDP, or whoever, it gives a lot of power to party bosses to decide who's in parliament and who, and it makes it a lot harder for MPs to rebel against, you know, the party headquarters. But also that, again, it's not a silver bullet. We've seen in the UK, which where MPs are elected from constituencies, there's high levels of party discipline in the UK still. It is quite hard for MPs to rebel. It happens from time to time. I mean, the Brexit vote is an example. A lot of Tory MPs voted against their own government, but that is quite rare. But I think there is more scope for people to rebel and to go against like the kind of party line. You know, obviously that's not always good, but sometimes you do want people, you do want free thinkers and people who aren't just yes men in parliament. You want people to be able to think a bit outside the box and so on. And as it currently stands, you know, there isn't really an opportunity for people to do that. They've got to listen to the government because, oh, not the government, the party that put them into parliament, because they can be easily removed. It's not like, you know, when you become an MP, you don't have the same rights. I mean, you'll be able to. I mean, you're a Labour lawyer. I don't think you have the same rights as a normal employee when you're an MP. The party can just say, look, you went against whatever, you said something we didn't like. I mean, Ronaldo Jose is an example. Just like, what do you think about him? I do think he was treated poorly. He said he did some silly things 10 years ago, and he was kicked out of being an MP with no recourse, and not the same as being an employee. So, but I think if there's different ways of electing MPs, people might have more opportunity and scope to rebel and to go against the party line.
No, well, it's. I imagine that changing electoral systems anywhere is an happens very, very rarely. But it's interesting to know that we are on the cusp of that possibility. Perhaps because things have to have got that bad for that momentum to have been reached. Marius, thank you very much for joining us. I would commend to those who have the stomach for the detail to have a look at the report, which is on the IRR website. And
thanks, Sarah.
Let's see what the next few years bring, as the Chinese curse says. Thank you.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
There have been reports this week about the dire situation that Transnet is in, and it is dealt with the fact that Transnet cannot service its debt without further government support. And this is in circumstances where weaknesses in the company's operations are going to take even more time to improve. Now, Standard & Poor's, one of the rating agencies, recently downgraded Transnet, which operates both rail and ports, and they foresee very little chance of an upgrade over the next year. It's in the process of implementing a turnaround plan, and this is crucial to improving the ability to do business, the ability to move goods, and the ability to grow the economy, and it being key to the issue, and as a result of it being in such debt and being in that vicious cycle, it means that its financial struggles prohibit it from affording to invest in improving its rail network. And it continues to push customers away. It decreases revenue and further worsens its financial position. So you've got the uphill battle, given the extent of rehabilitation of the network, which we know has just been degraded, stolen, and been poorly maintained, aged infrastructure, and ongoing security incidents. So this is all the contents of the stew that is making Transnet or unable to provide the service that it needs to because it cannot improve its financial situation. It's been heavily reliant on state support during its period of financial deterioration. And in the 2024 financial year, it realized a 7.33 billion rand loss and significant liabilities as a result. Now, Moody's, who's another rating agency, in May of this year warned that Transnet would run out of money for operations and for debt servicing within 3 months unless it gets a government bailout. And so to deal with this, the Transport Minister, Barbara Creasy, who by all accounts is a competent minister and is pushing the revitalization of Transnet into an entity that will probably look very different to the current Transnet. It's for a whole lot of reasons of the past and just the way that globally change is occurring. These very big organizations that provide these key services just cannot continue to look as they do. That applies to Transnet, the ports, Eskom, and similar entities. So what the two, together with the Minister of Finance, they agreed to provide Transnet with a $51 billion guarantee facility in May. Standard & Poor's has welcomed this and acknowledged the guarantee package, but says it's not enough. And by all accounts, a lot of the pushback against the reform that needs to happen in Transnet is coming from the management of Transnet, not from the people who rely on the service and not on the ministry that is responsible for it. So perhaps that will come as no surprise to people who've been watching Transnet disintegrate over the last few years. In a similar vein, and it's been spoken of before, but I think it's always worth restating, and in a way it's good news because it's such bad news, is that the National Health Insurance Scheme, as it is envisaged by the Minister of Health, will require personal income tax rates to more than double. And in the event that that happens, healthcare spending will also consume a third of the state's entire budget. Now, we've reached a point already where we can't increase the trying to increase personal income tax is actually pushing us over the edge and will result in recovering less tax as time goes by. And this whole move to create this centralized NHI scheme, which is essentially a funding model. It doesn't actually fix hospitals, which would have to be done before those hospitals can participate in the NHI scheme anyway. So the threat to collapse the current healthcare system is very real, and estimates are that as a result, there would be a 43% reduction in access to care for South Africans who pay for private medical aid. And this is according to the Health Funders Association, which represents about more than 21 medical aid schemes and three groups of administrators. We would all suffer, but the working class and low-income individuals who are on private medical aid schemes and are on schemes tailored to what they can afford to be on will bear the brunt of this. There are 9 million South Africans on medical, over 9 million South Africans on medical schemes, and they form part of the country's tax base. They are paying 74%, those people who belong to medical aid schemes, of personal income tax that is worth 443 billion rands. Now, if this goes up to rises by over two times the current average rate, it will literally consume both our personal resources that we rely on to lead decent lives, and it will just literally hollow out the budget, because a third of the budget will go to healthcare, while the other two-thirds will have to go to absolutely everything else that the government promises. It will also bring medical aid coverage to an end. I think it is so unlikely to happen because probably in and of itself it would grind the state to a standstill.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This is perhaps not so much an item of good news as an item of fun news, and that is that the register of parliamentary members' interests have just been released, 600 pages worth. And the sort of things that members of parliament have been gifted, which they have declared are stuffed animals, 48 bottles of wine, a leather hat, a shotgun cartridge case, biltong, a field bar, cooler, 4 Nguni hides, a windbreaker, a mohair jersey, and a beekeeping suit and instruction manual. I'm not sure if South Africa, the South African Parliament, leads the way in the variety and nature of benefits it receives from various interest groups. But John Steenhuisen, the Minister of Agriculture, has definitely scored the most, and it's possible, probably because of it's the agricultural sector is a very hospitable one. He received a tartan wool tie, an ostrich RSA flag with plumes, and a breakfast display of various cereals of unknown value from PepsiCo, which is an extraordinary concept, macadamia products, and ostrich meats. Otherwise, he had nothing to clear. He does not perform paid work outside Parliament, has no sponsorships, and declared a townhouse of 112 square meters in Sea Point. Poor old Col Niehaus, on the other hand, declared absolutely nothing. No gifts, no land, no property, no shares, no financial interests, no work outside Parliament, no directorships or partnerships, no sponsorships, no gifts, nothing. I think that's probably the ultimate sign of failure to represent anything that anybody or any group may be interested in. Julius Malema didn't declare much. There were certainly no shares and other interests. He is a director of a private company involved in farming events and sales activities, whatever that means, a bottle of wine, and Lindt Lindor chocolates from the Chinese embassy. Wow, maybe our foreign policy really does need some tightening up. He is, however, a trustee and beneficiary of three trusts. But perhaps the one that we should watch, robust and personable in a gruff way as Gate McKenzie may be, I've expressed concerns about his alliance with the truth, or the lack of an alliance with the truth. He's involved in more than 28 companies, either as a director or in partnership. And this covers logistics, media, mining and exploration, film and television, a microbrewery, a record label, health and wellness, nightclubs and entertainment, and liquid gas distribution. Maybe the distribution of gas is the most that is coming out of all the benefits that Mr. McKenzie, our Minister of Sports, Culture and Related Activities, is going to show us. But, more power to them for having disclosed some extraordinary benefits, or not so much benefits, or no benefits, of being an MP. With that in mind, I thank you for being with me this week, and I look forward to seeing you again next week when we will delve into that opaque and murky world that is South African politics. See you then.